Hello and welcome to this special edition of the NewsHour podcast. It is the second in our two-part bonus series in the run-up to the US presidential election. And I'm the second James, in chronological order at least, to be your host. My NewsHour colleague James Menendez brought you a discussion on one of the election's big themes, immigration, from San Antonio in Texas. Check it out when you've listened to this, if you haven't already. And I'm James Kamarasamy in Madison, Wisconsin, where we're going to chew over what American voters say is the most important issue for them in this election, the economy and the cost of living in particular. We're going to look at how people have been affected and how it might influence the outcome of this election. Well, I am sitting in the Wisconsin Memorial Union. With me, I've got Laura Dresser, a Labour economist at the University of Wisconsin, and Sean Johnson, who covers politics for Wisconsin Public Radio here in Madison. Welcome, both of you. I suppose I should welcome myself since I'm in your city or something like that. But look, it's really good to have you both with us. Let's start with where we are. Laura, tell us a bit about this building.
This is the Memorial Union, the gathering place of students and faculty and actually a lot of people from town. Beautiful view of the lake out the back and a lot of beer and bands playing all summer long on the terrace.
Beer and bands, that sounds good. Somewhere you'd hang out, Sean?
Yeah, when you have visitors who come to town, you bring them here and you show them the lake in the summer, maybe not in the winter.
bit blowy at the moment. Well, look, thank you both for being with us. And look, we're at the end of an election campaign. In fact, not too many yards from where we're sitting right now, there's a lot of early voting going on. This is an actual voting place. How's the campaign been for you, Laura?
Well, living in a swing state is, I think, like living it with the volume up to 11 all the time. And so, you know, there's a lot of activity, a lot of angst, a lot of things going on, and that's the experience of living here.
A lot of adverts on the TV.
Absolutely. Nonstop.
How about you, Sean?
I think when you're trying to keep up with it as a news story, it's exhausting, and you just want it to end by this point. I mean, you're trying to do your own little unique reporting, and then candidates keep visiting. I mean, we had
those pesky candidates.
They just keep coming. They like Wisconsin a lot this time of year, and especially this year.
Now, it was a former vice presidential nominee who at a debate said, "Who am I? What am I doing here?" I know who I am. I think I know why I'm here, but I want you to explain to our listeners why Wisconsin is so important and so interesting.
Because, I guess in short, we're one of a handful of states where voters have shown a willingness to change their minds. We have enough voters in the middle that Wisconsin could plausibly go either Republican or Democrat in any given presidential election. In our last two presidential elections, actually four of our last six were decided by less than a percentage point. So we're about as swingy as it gets for swing states.
Swingy as it gets, Laura. Let's talk about the economic conditions for people here in Wisconsin. Can you give us a bit of an overview of the last few years?
For sure. I think, you know, one of the things I do is write a report annually about the state of working Wisconsin. And I think what I've seen over the last few years is a really strong, if you're rooted in the questions of unemployment and wage trends, even wages relative to inflation, if you're looking for closing gaps in inequality, you know, you see a pretty strong economy. The picture, obviously, among the electorate is much more mixed than that. But like from the data, we see a lot of evidence that workers have leverage and that they are using that leverage in formal and informal, individual and collective ways.
What does that mean for wages, for example?
For wages, for example, the strongest wage trends over the last, sort of in the post-pandemic shutdown recovery period, the strongest wage trends have been posted by the lowest wage workers. Their wages are up by eight times as much as higher wage workers are, both higher and lower wage workers above the rate of inflation. But so really strong advances at the bottom of the labor market. And that's something I haven't seen since the late 1990s.
But inflation.
Inflation, I think, really through workers and people's experience of this economy, I think when you turn to reports on what the economy feels like to people, they are talking more about stress. In spite of the fact that on average, I can show their wages went up faster than inflation, you know, that doesn't feel that way. And I think inflation, especially the levels we hit in 2022, was a completely new experience for almost every working person. People who are still in the labor market don't really remember the late 70s. And so it's a completely new experience and really disturbing. And it piles on top of underlying stress in workers, especially around the high cost items like housing, like childcare, and like healthcare in this economy.
Well, there are other costs as well. I guess there's food stuff as well. I'm just going to turn now. We'll get on to the politics in a minute, Sean, but let's have a listen to this, because just to get a sense of how people on lower incomes have been affected. A little earlier today, I went to a food pantry on the outskirts of this city. It's organised by the Badger Prairie Needs Network. It's kind of like a small supermarket. There are lots of fresh food. There's tins and packets. There are treats for the kids. And the people using it, I mean, they're wheeling shopping trolleys around. It is really like a supermarket. I've been to a few food pantries back home in England, but this is very different. And I heard the scale of the challenge from the woman who oversees the distribution of the food. But also, we spoke to one of the people who uses a pantry. Her name is Leah.
I am here more so because the prices of groceries have went skyrocket. Whether you make $20 an hour to $25 an hour, whether you're working full-time or part-time, it's still tight when it comes to groceries. I am a single mother. It's stressful.
Are you in work at the moment, Leah?
Yes, I am.
But even with work, with a wage coming in, you're finding it tough to survive?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's very hard to pay for groceries now. Everything is so expensive, from the eggs to the bread. I've noticed, especially within this past year or two, more people are starting to come to pantries due to expenses being so high. It's kind of insane how long the lines can get at the pantries, and it's people who make a good salary, but still the groceries are extremely high.
How do you feel about that?
It's upsetting. It's troubling to the mind at the same time, because you kind of got to get in survival mode. Makes you wonder, like, okay, like, am I going to be able to survive later on in life? Like, what if these prices continue to skyrocket? Like, what will we do then at that point? Like, how will we survive at that point?
And just a thought about coming to a food pantry. Does it bother you?
At first, it was like a little bit bothering, only because it makes you feel like I can't provide for me and my household. It bothers you to think like, okay, I only have enough money to pay my bills and now I'm short on food. So it does make you feel kind of down to a certain extent.
So we've come to get the bigger picture, and we are in a much bigger room, a warehouse, and I'm joined by Michelle Orgay, who's president and executive director of the Second Harvest Food Bank. Michelle, now tell us about the needs that you have had to cater for. How have things been changing over the last few years, say?
There was a lot of news coverage during the early pandemic. And during the pandemic, there were those drone footage of and stories about cars lined up for miles getting the food from our partners. We're distributing much more food than that. The food insecurity rates are higher. There are folks who are using pantries that had never used them before. Yesterday, we distributed more food in a single day than we've ever done ever before.
I suppose the question, Laura, to that last point is why? On the same day that they were doing the biggest ever distribution, new economic figures are out showing the US economy grew by 2.8% in the last quarter. It all sounds rosy, but individuals are still getting hit, aren't they?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I've tried to working with others, to try to document is this distance from what low-wage jobs in this country provide and what it costs to live. And I think with a kind of neglected minimum wage, with weak bargaining power, especially among low-wage jobs, we have bad jobs that come in extremely bad packages. They don't come with health insurance. They don't come with paid time off. They don't come with pension plans. And workers in low-wage jobs struggle to get enough hours, to get enough food to the table, and they have to make up the difference in these social supports that take a lot of time as well and create a lot of stress.
Well, let's turn to the politics of this. We're going to hear some of the campaign ads that have addressed the cost of living. First of all, one from the Republican Party.
Anybody who's gone to the grocery store or filled up their gas tank in the last month knows that the bills are going up a little bit again. Gas was up a little bit. Food was up a little bit. Eggflation is bad.
Still a thing.
It's definitely costing more to go about your daily routine.
Americans, it's not working.
Folks, no accident. That's Bidenomics in action.
When I am elected president, I will make it a top priority to bring down costs and increase economic security for all Americans. As president, I will take on the high costs that matter most to most Americans, like the cost of food. We all know that prices went up during the pandemic when the supply chains shut down and failed. But our supply chains have now improved, and prices are still too high.
And that, of course, at the end there, the Democratic Party candidate, Kamala Harris. So, Sean, what about the cost of living as a political issue? How is it figuring into the campaign?
It is figuring into the campaign in an enormous way, really. If you look just at polling on the race from Marquette University, which has consistently polled Wisconsin for the last 12 years, so we have kind of a good baseline of results from them. And the economy is far and away the number one issue of the issues that they poll voters on. I think 38% said it was their top issue. Abortion was the number two issue, and it was 15. And it's the only issue where you have both Republicans and Democrats saying that it's an issue for them. It's mostly driven by Republicans, but you have both parties that are saying this is a concern for them. And I think just anecdotally, you can go out anywhere and just talk to people and say, you know, what are you voting on? What are the issues for you? And you'll get people to talk about the economy. And you will not get into a nuanced conversation about whether wages have kept pace with inflation. You will hear from people say, God, I went to the grocery store and it cost me $100 to get this food that used to cost me much less. They sort of feel it at a gut level on a regular basis. And so that reinforces it as an issue that they care about. I mean,
that clearly is a challenge for the party in power.
Absolutely. I mean, I used to talk to Laura actually about 12 years ago. We had another issue, an economics issue, that was job growth was something that the candidates were campaigning on all the time. And there was this idea that if there was a good jobs report, you know, that was good for the party in power. If it was a bad jobs report, well, that was bad. Nobody cares about that now. We have record low unemployment, record high employment. They are very concerned about how much it costs to buy stuff. And that is driving the debate.
Yeah, I was thinking that myself, actually, is the jobs figures were the ones that were always the most closely examined this close to the election. But why not? Is it just because unemployment's in a good place?
That probably takes a psychologist smarter than me, but to say why not? Great September jobs report, great quarterly growth report, just really great stats racked up by this economy, and none of it really breaking through to a sense of security or strength for workers. It's one of the conundrums of talking about the economy, even from the location I do, like based in all this data. It comes off as dissonant from what people feel like is going on.
So, Sean, the Republicans on the front foot, if you like, on this one. We heard in the advert they are tying Kamala Harris to Joe Biden's economic strategy. She's very much on the defensive, saying, look, I have a plan, but I accept that prices are still high. Are people who are thinking about the economy in the election thinking back to the Trump presidency and its economic policy in different ways to the way they did when he was in power? How would you assess it?
I think nostalgia is a powerful force, right? And for Republicans, that is something you hear often when you talk to people. They say, well, look, whatever you think about the candidates, you have to admit things were better back then. That is a recurring thing that I hear when I talk to Republicans out there. And again, this is something that's backed up by Marquette's polling. If you look at what people talk about in terms of how they feel about whether they're doing all right or they're struggling, the numbers are much worse now than they were compared to 2020. Again, this is regardless of the actual state of the economy. This is how people are feeling, and they are definitely feeling worse in terms of, you know, their economic situation. But prominently from Republicans, you do hear that a lot, that I missed those days of 4 years ago.
Let's turn to some of the more specific Wisconsin aspects of the economy. It is a state that is politically divided between the urban and rural areas. not unlike quite a few American states. Now, when I was in the Southwest, I met Steve Prestigard. He's the editor of the Platteville Journal, and he described the town, it's in Grant County, as a blueberry in a sea of red jello. You like that one. But he also told me that the economies of the two, the blueberry and the red jello, can't be separated.
Rural incomes are not ever to the extent of incomes in more urban areas. That's just kind of always been the case. If you have a lower income just because that's the way things are for you, and everything else is more expensive, such as utility costs, heating your house, such as buying a new vehicle, car prices have just gone through the roof, and the cost of getting a car loan has increased substantially as well. All those are the sorts of things that people who have less income, it's going to be a problem for them.
So that's the kind of impact on a day-to-day of some of these rural communities.
Yeah, basically that's the case. And a lot of these rural communities also, and a lot of people don't realize this, the businesses even in town are very tied to the rural economy. I mean, there's, you know, farm implement places, tractor dealer down the road, places that do repairs for those things. And even the farm economy affects a place like a hardware store. So the farm economy really affects everybody around here.
So, Laura, the rural and urban economies, how connected are they?
I mean, I think that there's an easy way to tell a tale of quite distinct differences, especially of the difference between Dane County, the county that surrounds Madison, where we are today, and the rest of the state. Population growth and job growth and most of the economic growth in this state is driven right now by Dane County. And there is, in the rural counties, declining population, declining jobs, and aging population, seriously aging population. And that dynamic of growth in the one urban center with the university and all that, relative to a kind of stagnant or declining rural economy, is core to many of the divisions that the state has. At the same time, we have Milwaukee, not incredible dynamism there, but a kind of core of the manufacturing economy of the state, and also one of the place, 80% of the African Americans in the state live in Milwaukee. And so I think between Milwaukee and Madison, you have a kind of different economic stories, but both get played as very far from the rural aspects of the economy, the rural concerns in this economy. At the same time, there are a lot of connections. There are increasingly numbers of workers coming in from other counties to work in Dane County. The growth spills over and labor pools run across in all directions. And then also there's, you know, obviously the inputs and the resources that come from rural areas come into the cities. And so, like, we're all connected in a way, but there's a lot of distinction, and I would say that underlying economic difference plays into some of the divisiveness that we see at the political level, probably.
And Sean, when it comes to cities, there are the centers and then there are the suburbs, and they have different dynamics and they have different political feels as well, don't they? And they could be crucial, the suburbs, certainly around Milwaukee, in this election. I think you've done some reporting there. Just tell us a little bit about those dynamics.
Yeah, I think if you were going to give kind of a shorthand case on the politics of Wisconsin, you have Dane County, where we're at, and Milwaukee County. Those are the Democratic vote centers. Rural Wisconsin is very Republican. And then the suburbs used to be the foundation of Republican support. And they still are, but not so much as they used to be. They have created an opening for Democrats, largely among disaffected Republicans in the age of Trump, people who aren't comfortable voting for him, because that is when Republican numbers really started to slip off in 2016, and that has continued in this state even when the former president is not on the ballot. And so that's the thing. I think the suburbs will be won and lost potentially by those voters, not necessarily over economic issues, but over personality issues, whether or not these people who voted Republican their whole life are comfortable voting for Donald Trump in 2024.
Are there economic factors as well?
I mean, I think it's still a top issue for voters in the suburbs. When you talk to people there, they list it like they do in other regions of the state. I just think that, I mean, you have a different type of economy there. You have a lot of extremely well-off neighborhoods in the suburbs where, you know, people who voted for many other Republicans, Mitt Romney, George W. Bush, you name it, they're a little iffy when it comes to President Trump.
Okay, well, look, we're going to end with a bit of Wisconsin economic history, stretching things a little bit. When we were in the southwest of the state, we popped into the Platteville Mining and Rollo Jameson Museums, where our guide was Christina.
So welcome to our 1845 Lorenzo Bevins lead mine. So if you take a look around...
First up, or rather down, the mines. And in the mid-19th century, immigrants from Cornwall in the west of England were among the miners attracted to Wisconsin by its rich mineral deposits, initially lead, but later zinc. They only had cloth caps for protection, but amazingly, in this mine at least, there were no fatalities.
All right, Winnie. Oh, close. Yes!
Woohoo! Hey, way to go, Winnie.
After a short trip on Winnie, an old mining train, Christina explained the connection between the men who used to travel in it and the origins of Wisconsin's nickname, the Badger State.
So you had immigrants from all over the world, and additionally from other parts of America, coming here and staking out land so that way they could mine. They'd build their houses over it, or their badger huts, they would be called later on. What they would do is sometimes they'd peek their little heads out of their mine shafts, and people started calling them badgers.
In another part of the museum, not too far away, a collection of curiosities. From a self-playing Kimball piano, which uses pedal pressure and carefully perforated paper rolls to make music, to a pair of stuffed squirrels dressed as fighters in a boxing ring. And a Wisconsin museum wouldn't be a Wisconsin museum without a tribute to the dairy produce for which the state is famous.
So we have these awesome butter presses here that made these beautiful little designs in the butter.
Such was Wisconsin's love of butter that when a cheaper alternative, margarine, was invented in the 19th century, it was banned in this state. A margarine smuggling black economy soon sprung up. And the butter versus margarine debate even entered politics. Here's our guide, Christina, lifting the butter dish lid on how one local politician got his comeuppance in the 1950s.
And so here in Platteville, we had a senator, Senator Roselip, and he said that he knew the difference between margarine and butter. He'd be able to taste the difference, and butter was the best by far. So they put him to the test. They did a blind taste test with him. So they gave him a sample of butter, and they gave him a sample of margarine, and he chose margarine as the better tasting of the two.
Bit like the Pepsi test.
Yes. And so allegedly later on his wife came forward and admitted that she had been feeding him margarine for the past couple of years instead of butter.
So there we go. A bit of butter politics in Wisconsin now. I'm going to quiz you both. I'm the outsider. You're the locals. What is the punishment for only offering margarine in a restaurant to this day in Wisconsin? Can you answer that one?
Oh my gosh. I think you get slathered in butter and sent down a slide. I don't know.
As a felony, I'm sure. You have to leave. Go to Illinois.
Yeah, well, go to Illinois. That's the worst possible place you could go. $500 fine, 3 months in jail. Technically, that is still on the books, apparently. Funnily enough, it's not enforced ever, I suspect, but it's still on the books. So it tells you a lot about the way dairy is seen in this state, doesn't it? Is there still a lot of dairy pride?
There was a lawmaker who tried to get that taken off the books a few years ago because he said it was a stupid law, and he had no co-sponsors. People don't want to touch dairy in the state. They're happy to just not enforce laws like that, but they're going to leave them on the books.
I mean, honestly, we're a state of people who put a giant foam cheese on our head in celebration of cheese. There's no end to the love for dairy here.
So unity through cows and
Maybe the Packers.
Yeah, the Green Bay Packers and dairy products for sure.
And yeah. Well, and probably beer.
Yeah, although I was going to say Donald Trump did bring out a Packer star quarterback to his rally, so maybe that's anyway. But beer, okay. So beer and dairy, we can agree on that, can we? Yes, good. Well, look, thanks, Sean. Thanks, Sean and Laura. And thank you for downloading this special bonus edition of the NewsHour podcast. And if you're not already, please do subscribe to the feed so you can receive future episodes of NewsHour and bonus content like this as soon as it's available.